President Lyndon Johnson spoke to the nation.
All I have, I would have given gladly not to be standing here today. An assassin's bullet has thrust upon me the awesome burden of the presidency. No memorial oration or eulogy could more eloquently honor President Kennedy's memory than the earliest possible passage of the Civil Rights Bill for which he fought so long.
But President Johnson was not successful in setting a course the nation would follow in Southeast Asia. All across the country, students were dropping out of school in protest of our policies there. Some went on peace marches or set up communes. Others made bombs that killed and disrupted life around them. Most said they were going to make the world a better place, but there were many in the land who doubted young people's motives. And in the continuing surge and counter-surge of Vietnam protest, a group of students was fired on by the National Guard at Kent State in Ohio in 1970. Four were killed. National Guard General Robert Canterbury.
Many members of the crowd closed in on our troops and assaulted them with rocks. Many guardsmen were hit by rocks about the size of baseballs. At that point, the guardsmen fired many tear gas rounds at the crowd. In fact, fired all tear gas rounds on hand at that time. The order was given to return to the commons, and the troops moved out. A crowd estimated at several hundred closed in and assaulted the guard force again with rocks and pieces of concrete. These guardsmen considered that their lives were in danger, which in fact was the case.
The father of 19-year-old Allison Krause, one of the victims.
She resented being called a bum because she disagreed with someone else's opinion. She felt that war in Cambodia was wrong. Is this dissent a crime? Is this a reason for killing her? Have we come to such a state in this country that a young girl has to be shot because she disagrees deeply with the actions of her government?
The stories covered by CBS News overlaid each other as the 1960s ended and the 70s began. One of them was the condition of women. The Supreme Court gave limited approval to abortion, and people of both sexes began reevaluating themselves and their roles. The CBS News reported in a CBS radio special about women in 1973. Clearly, the American woman is beginning to avail herself of the new options opening up for her, options she never dared consider before. The sheer number of women moving out on their own is so great, and the directions in which they are moving so varied, that behavioral conformity is about as obsolete as Detroit's year-end models. Of course, what must be borne in mind is that it's not simply the men who have all the readjusting to do. The American woman is having difficulties not only because some are carrying out their own experiments with independence and have male backlash to deal with, but because a great mass of American women are largely content. For while liberation has been tagged a woman's movement, the more appropriate term in the end may conceivably become a people's movement. Men and women looking at each other with new awareness. CBS News correspondents and reporters covered the continuing story of politics and presidents. In 16 years, we elected four presidents to the Oval Office. Two gained it unelected. One was assassinated. CBS Radio on that unforgettable day, November 22nd, 1963.
The motorcade, something has happened here. We understand there has been a shooting. The presidential car coming up now. We know it's the presidential car. You see Mrs. Kennedy's pink suit. There's a Secret Service man, spread eagle, over the top of the car. We understand Governor and Mrs. Connolly are in the car with President and Mrs. Kennedy. We can't see who has been hit, if anybody's been hit, but apparently something is wrong here. Something is terribly wrong.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States is dead. John F. Kennedy has died of the wounds received in an assassination in Dallas.
CBS News correspondent Alan Jackson. After that, there was a rash of similar killings. Malcolm X in 1965, and then 1968, a year of unremitting major news stories. Martin Luther King is shot. CBS Radio at the moment of crisis.
I was in room 309. Dr. King was in room 306, less than 60 feet away. As soon as I turned on the television set, he came on the screen, speaking to the audience he had addressed the night before. He was saying very powerfully that he was ready to die.
Difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. And I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live.
When the program ended, I reached over to turn the set down. That was when I heard the shot ring out, and I rushed out on the balcony. I saw Dr. King lying about 40 feet away. Ralph Abernathy was there, and so was Andy Young. Police poured down the street, running with rifles. The scene was confused and frantic. An ambulance arrived, but there wasn't much anyone could do. I knew they had killed him. It was hard to believe, after all the threats and close calls, that it had finally happened here, at a motel in Memphis, Tennessee.
That same year, Robert Kennedy, the dead president's brother, decided to run for president. The incumbent president, Lyndon Baines Johnson, decided not to.
I have concluded that I should not permit the presidency to become involved in the partisan divisions that are developing in this political year. Accordingly, I shall not seek and I will not accept the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
A surprise to almost everyone but the president himself. And then it was June. Robert Kennedy won the California primary, an evening that began for Kennedy in triumph and ended in yet more bloodshed.
My thanks to all of you, and now it's on to Chicago, and let's win there.
Senator Kennedy has been shot. Is that possible? Is that possible? It could be. Is it possible, ladies and gentlemen? It is possible. He has. Not only Senator Kennedy. Oh, my God. Senator Kennedy has been shot. Possibly shot in the head.
He still has the gun. The gun is pointed at me right at this moment. I hope they can get the gun out of his hand. Be very careful. Get the gun.
Take a hold of his thumb and break it if you have to. Get his thumb.
All right. That's it, Rayford. Get it. Hold him. We don't want another Oswald.
My brother need not be idealized or enlarged in death beyond what he was in life. To be remembered simply as a good and decent man who saw wrong and tried to right it, saw suffering and tried to heal it, saw war and tried to stop it. Those of us who loved him and who take him to his rest today pray that what he was to us, what he wished for others, will someday come to pass for all the world. As he said many times in many parts of this nation, to those he touched and who sought to touch him, some men see things as they are and say, why? I dream things that never were and say, why not?
Richard Nixon won a first term as president and then another, and in 1974 resigned from office, his career shattered by the Watergate scandal. For the next 2 years, President Nixon's chosen successor, Gerald Ford, tried to keep the nation on an even keel. And in 1976, Jimmy Carter, driving for the presidency, pledged in his campaign to lead the nation to a new beginning.
I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow. I regret deeply any injuries that may have been done in the course of the events that led to this decision. To those who have stood with me during these past difficult months, I will be eternally grateful for your support. And to those who have not felt able to give me your support, let me say, I leave with no bitterness.
My fellow Americans, our long national nightmare is over.
It's now time for healing. We want to have faith again. We want to be proud again. We just want the truth again. It's time for the people to run the government and not the other way around.
Watergate was the worst scandal involving the head of government since the Teapot Dome of the 1920s, and perhaps the worst in all our history. The Senate Watergate Committee hearings were carried in their entirety, more than 119 hours on CBS radio. Former White House counsel John Dean was a key witness.
As the president discussed the present status of the situation, I told him that all I've been able to do was to contain the case and assist in keeping it out of the White House. I also told him that there was a long way to go before this matter would end, and that I certainly could make no assurances that the day would not come when this matter would not start to unravel. I began by telling the president that there was a cancer growing on the presidency, and that if the cancer was not removed, the president himself would be killed by it. I also told him that it was important that this cancer be removed immediately, because it was growing more deadly every day.
But the nation heard about its triumphs as well as its tragedies on CBS radio. The first man on the moon, astronaut Neil Armstrong, July 20th, 1969.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue.
I'm at the foot of the ladder. The LAM footbeds are only depressed in the surface about 1 or 2 inches, although the surface appears to be very, very fine-grained as you get close to it. It's almost like a powder. Ground mass is very fine. I'm going to step off the LAM now. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
And the United States celebrated its 200th birthday, a vast and unprecedented challenge to CBS News radio coverage.
We lost the American colonies because we lacked that statesmanship to know the right time and the manner of yielding what is impossible to keep.
They came here in the snows of winter over a trail marked with the blood of their rag-bound feet. Americans will remember the name of Valley Forge as long as the spirit of sacrifice lives within their hearts.
Many challenges remain subjects of extensive CBS News coverage on radio as our decade winds down. The economy, energy, and natural resources, our environment, the condition of the cities, and other overriding news stories, known and unknown. CBS News correspondent Eric Severide's career in news has spanned this era in which CBS News has moved toward maturity. Severide reached retirement age in 1977, but recently in a CBS News radio special dealing with American wisdom, he commented on what our past has taught us and our ability to meet the challenges that lie ahead.
There remains in American spirit an implicit belief that problems can be solved. Maybe there is an innocence about this country's approach to life. And this innocence gets us into a lot of trouble. Yet this instinct amounts to a kind of wisdom, for it bears on the preservation of the species. It makes creativity possible. It says yes to life and no to cynicism, which is death for the spirit. Man may be trapped between earth and a glimpse of heaven, but no people fasten on a glimpse so steadily. With all our innocent and damaging mistakes, the world is fortunate in the end that one great nation at least believes in a better and better life. Perhaps that is why millions of people in other lands still want to come here. America is not what's wrong with the world. For ordinary people, it is the best thing that ever happened to the world. And this knowledge, this wisdom, is a calm eye at the center of the hurricane of our self-criticism, our periodic self-doubt.
The development of broadcast news, a 50-year experiment on CBS radio, that continues. Tomorrow will teach us something else.
And now, Bill Schallert with a closing word from General Electric.
Next year, the General Electric Company will be 100 years old.
And tonight, you've heard about some of the progress that General Electric research has made possible in those 100 years. If the past is any guide to the future, they'll keep right on making it. Energy, transportation, the environment, those are just some of the fields where GE is working right now. And as you might expect, they're making progress. Progress for people from General Electric.
Now, with a closing report, CBS News correspondent Walter Cronkite.
Radio has changed as America's listening habits have changed. During the 3 hours of this, CBS Radio's 50th anniversary special, we've been hearing how it used to be. Today, radio at CBS sounds like this.
First Line Report.
I'm Bob Schieffer, CBS.
This is Dallas Townsend with the CBS World News Roundup.
Newsbreak. Charles Osgood on the
CBS. Newsbreak PM. This is Reed Collins.
What's happening? I'm Stephanie Shelton reporting
the
on
world
the
world of religion.
I'm Douglas Edwards, CBS.
In the spotlight, this is Lee Jordan.
The Law and You. I'm Fred Graham. CBS.
It's Your Earth. I'm Nelson Benton.
The CBS Radio Mystery Theater. Welcome. I'm E.G. Marshall.
Good morning. Jim Kelly with the Sports World Roundup on the CBS.
Pat Summerall on the CBS Radio Network with predictions.
Win Elliott, Sports Center at USA for the...
I'm Ron Weber with Sports Time.
I'm Brent Musburger with Sports
Time. Time now to meet the cook. Ralph Story here.
Big Line America. I'm Charles Carroll.
Washington Watch. I'm Bruce Morton, CBS.
This is
News.
Charles Collingwood reporting.
Face the Nation. A spontaneous...
Morley Safer's Journal commentary.
Mike Wallace at large.
This is Lawrence Johnson on the CBS Radio Network with What's New and Learning.
Reporter at large. I'm Leslie Stahl.
I'm Phyllis Schlafly for Spectrum.
This is The World Tonight. Good evening. I'm Douglas Edwards.
This is Walter Cronkite reporting.
Today in Business, I'm Ray Brady reporting.
Mormon Tabernacle Choir from Temple Square in Salt Lake City.
William S. Paley, who was there when it all began, remains firmly committed to radio as a central method of modern communication.
Radio is a very important medium. I don't think most people realize the importance of it. From the standpoint of national security, it's absolutely essential. It's the only medium that can reach all the people at a moment's notice, no matter what calamity might befall the country. So it's a necessary medium. And at the same time, of course, it takes care of people who either don't like television or who are too busy to be sitting in front of a television set, who want to walk around and be entertained or informed. It's becoming more and more of an information medium. Oh, it's really divided almost in two. Either stations that put a great accent on music, practically nothing else with just a few minutes of news every once in a while, and stations that put a great accent on information and discussion. And we chose the latter course. It's a more expensive way of going about it, but it does provide a very important service. And I think it's a product that is indestructible from the standpoint of the kind of demand that there will always be for it. I pride myself in the quality of our news organization. It's certainly by far the best of any organization in broadcasting, and I think it compares favorably with any organization, even in the print media. And therefore, we're better equipped to do an all-news station operation than almost any other network or any other organization.
William Paley. For the last 3 hours, we've been sharing with you a look back at CBS Radio's first 50 years. Undoubtedly, there were voices and sounds you expected to hear and did not. We hope that those you did hear, you enjoyed. They may have carried you back, and perhaps in the larger picture, informed you. I'm Walter Cronkite, CBS News.
You have been listening to a special 3-hour CBS Radio anniversary broadcast. CBS Radio at 50, an autobiography in sound, sponsored by General Electric. This broadcast was written and produced by Joan Martin Burke with Maurice Lee Robinson. Technical supervision, Mortimer Goldberg. Assistant to the producers, Martin Werber. Research, Catherine Sultz. Executive producer, Dick Reeves. The entire production was supervised by Emerson Stone. Bob Height speaking. This is the CBS Radio Network.
And in just a moment, we'll have the nighttime news here on WCCO. Here's important news for you parents of children who plan to take part in their school music program. The sensible way to start your child's musical program is by taking advantage of the Chester E. Grove Music Company's famous Try Before You Buy plan.
whether the instrument is a violin, a trombone, trumpet, flute, clarinet, or any band or orchestral instrument you may choose, you rent the instrument first. The cost is low. That's based on the value of the instrument. But most important, if you decide to buy the instrument, your entire rental fee goes towards the purchase price. So don't buy any musical instrument until you've talked to the sales folks at the Growth Music Company. Let them tell you all about the name brand instruments that are sold at Growth Music. Remember, for all your music and musical instruments, shop the Chester E. Growth Music Company, 915 Marquette Avenue, downtown Minneapolis. The music store that knows what you want, and they have it. Your nighttime neighbor to the nation, this is WCCO, Minneapolis-St. Paul, Minnesota, at 830. It's 10 o'clock. Leading the news at this hour, plane crashes in northern Minnesota. This is the nighttime news on WCCO Radio. Here with a regional report, Dan Hertzgard.
A seaplane crashed this evening on Tioga Beach on Pokegama Lake near Grand Rapids in northern Minnesota. Itasca County authorities say they believe two persons aboard the plane were killed. The plane came down when it apparently was trying to land on the lake. Witnesses said the plane clipped a tree and flipped. The scene of the accident is about 5 miles south of Grand Rapids, and the names of the victims have not been revealed yet. The death toll in a one-car accident near Arlington, Minnesota last night climbed to 2 today when 17-year-old Michael Melsha of Arlington died in a suburban Minneapolis hospital. He was the son of Mr. and Mrs. Harold Melsha. The Sibley County Sheriff's Office said the Melsha youth was the driver of a car which rolled over about 10:30 last night on County Road 66, a half mile east of Arlington. 18-year-old John Sefker of Arlington died at the scene of the crash. At least 9 persons have died on Minnesota streets and highways during the weekend. Wisconsin authorities have reported 10 weekend deaths. Minnesota Congressman Don Fraser of Minneapolis is considering a challenge to Senator Wendy Anderson for the DFL endorsement for the U.S. Senate. And our government correspondent, Arv Johnson, talked with Fraser after he met with a group of DFL leaders at Zumbrota this weekend.
Fraser did not ask members of the 1st District DFL Executive Committee for any commitment, and he emphasized that he is not yet a candidate for the U.S. Senate endorsement, that he's just checking out possible support. After the meeting, his first outstate appearance since he expressed an interest in a challenge, I asked Fraser how soon he feels that he'll have to make a formal announcement.
I would think by the end of the year, I would need to make clear whether or not I was a candidate for party endorsement, because the party caucuses, both for the Republican and DFL party, occur in late February, and people would want to know, I think, well ahead of time, what one of the issues might be at the caucuses.
Why do you feel there should be a challenge to the appointed incumbent?
Well, I like to think that it isn't so much of a challenge as presenting myself as one of at least two candidates that the party might choose from. I've indicated that I have no plans to be critical of the fact that there is a temporary appointment. The statute required that there be one. On the other hand, there hasn't been any public or party involvement in that initial decision, so I try to make clear my conclusion that thus it is an open seat, and I'll present myself, and others will, and then the party makes its decision.
Later, I had a chance to ask Anderson how he feels about the potential competition.
Well, I think that Don has been a very good congressman. I think he has every right to look on a Senate seat. I personally welcome competition. I think we've had a good record as governor, as a state legislator, and now in the Senate. And I kind of like tough competition, and he'd be that.
Wendy Anderson appeared before a friendly crowd as he spoke to the opening Sunday evening session of the Minnesota AFL-CIO convention in St. Paul. The labor delegates gave Anderson a standing ovation and adopted a resolution urging him to seek a full term in the U.S. Senate next year, something which he fully intends to do. Arv Johnson, WCCO Radio, government correspondent.
Contract talks will resume later this week between union representatives and at least 2 iron mining companies in northeastern Minnesota. Officials of the United Steelworkers of America say talks are scheduled for Thursday and Friday in Duluth with representatives of Erie Mining and Hibbing Taconite, both owned by Pickens Mather Company. Talks between the union and other mining companies went into recesses of undetermined length last week after some bargaining sessions were held. Other talks could resume at any time. The strike by more than 18,000 steel workers in Minnesota and Upper Michigan is more than 6 weeks old. Another round of negotiations is scheduled, meanwhile, at Austin, Minnesota, this week between members of Local P9 and the George A. Hormel Company. At issue is the company's proposal for a new plant and perhaps the future of thousands of Hormel workers. The company says it must have a long-term, no-strike agreement with the union in order to invest in a new plant in Austin. The union says the company is trying to get a substandard contract. About 700 paper workers are scheduled to return to work at the Conwed Corporation in Cloquet tomorrow, ending a six-week-old strike. Members of Local 158, International Paper Workers Union, voted by a 2-to-1 margin yesterday to approve a new contract. North Central Airlines service between Mankato and the Twin Cities will be suspended at midnight tonight for 1 month while work is done on the main runway at the Mankato Municipal Airport. A 1,300-foot section of the 5,400-foot runway will be replaced, and the entire runway will receive new asphalt overlay. The second runway is too short for North Central's Convair 550 plane, but will remain open for smaller aircraft, with the exception of a day or two when resurfacing is done at the intersection of the two runways. The Mankato terminal will continue to accept freight shipments for the Twin Cities, but the freight will be flown from the airport at Fairmont. Service between the Twin Cities and Mankato is scheduled then to resume on October 22nd. Milwaukee businessman and politician David Carley has accused Wisconsin Governor Martin Schreiber and Revenue Secretary Dennis Conta of playing what he calls a cruel hoax on Wisconsin taxpayers. Carley, who is expected to challenge Schreiber in the Democratic primary next year, was critical of Conta's statement that the Schreiber administration might eliminate the corporate income tax. Carley says Conta's statement last week was, in Carley's words, obviously a political appeal to Wisconsin businessmen. And he added these same businessmen and hundreds of other much smaller Wisconsin wage earners will have to make up the difference in the revenue losses to the state, for there is no free lunch, even in state government budgets. WCCO Radio News time is 7 past 10 o'clock, 59 degrees. The majority leader of the Wisconsin State Senate says that minimum mandatory sentencing for violent crimes is an idea the state legislature can no longer ignore. Democratic Senator William Bablish of Stevens Point spoke today in the 9th District COPE dinner in Belgium, Wisconsin. And his remarks were in response to a news report which said two Milwaukee felons convicted earlier this year are already eligible for parole. Bablish said the reports give dramatic evidence of the absurdity to which our penal sentencing laws have reached. The men involved were convicted in February for the attempted murder of a Milwaukee policeman. One was sentenced up to 35 years, but was eligible for a parole hearing September 1st, and the other was sentenced to up to 20 years, arrived at Green Bay Reformatory August 23rd, and was immediately eligible for parole. Bablish said he will recommend that the Legislative Council appoint a special committee to review parole and to make recommendations as to minimum mandatory sentencing to the legislature for appropriate action. In Minnesota, the legislature has been working on determinate sentencing legislation for some time, and action is expected next year. Public hearings will continue this week into the level of service provided by the 72 largest gas, electric, and telephone utilities in Wisconsin. The State Public Service Commission today said the fourth in the series of 11 hearings will be at the Hill Farms State Office Building in Madison tomorrow. Other hearings this week are scheduled for the Beloit City Hall on Tuesday, the County Courthouse in Dodgeville Wednesday, and the Racine County Courthouse on Thursday. The hearings are set for 2 and 7 p.m. daily. The final hearing will be in Rhinelander, September 29th. The Metropolitan Sports Facilities Commission has scheduled another stadium inspection trip this week. Members will leave the Twin Cities tomorrow to tour facilities in Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, and Cincinnati. The commission was created by the 1977 legislature to decide on the type of new stadium to be built in the metro area, as well as to pick a site and operate the stadium when it is built. Two young men have been accused of burglarizing the Bloomington home of Max McGee, former Green Bay Packers football player. Police, who have charged Scott O'Keefe and Michael Staunton, both 18 years of age, with burglary, said both were residents of a halfway house in Minneapolis and are being held in Hennepin County Jail in lieu of $10,000 bond each. Jewelry, valued at $27,500 plus $1,000 in cash, was taken from McGee's home. One of the items taken is described as a 41.5-carat diamond ring valued at $22,000. Also among the loot, two football rings from the 1961 and 62 championship days of the Green Bay Packers. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources will hold a public auction at its Horicon headquarters October 8th for the right to trap fur bears in the Horicon Marsh Wildlife Area. DNR Area Supervisor Joseph Frank says there are 20 units available to bidders for the trapping rights. And he says high fur prices in recent years have brought many requests to trap muskrats and mink on the state's...